Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Tim Minchin is a multi-award winning composer, lyricist, musician, comedian, actor and writer. Born in the UK, raised in Australia, he's the creative force behind the smash hit Matilda the Musical and the Olivier Award winning Groundhog Day. He's also starred on screen and on stage in countless sellout tours, and we're so delighted to welcome him to the programme. Tim Minchin, you are very welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Dermot. Nice to talk to you across the planet.
It is a delight for me because, you know what, when I was just starting out in stand-up comedy, I think it was probably maybe 2006, I got to see you play in Edinburgh at the famous Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And you absolutely blew my mind because I had never seen a comedian who was also a rock star. And I couldn't get over the reaction of the crowd.
Well, that's really nice. I guess I was still in the Gilded Balloon that year, wasn't I? And
yeah,
that was only my second year in Edinburgh and really only my third year of doing comedy. But it all sort of, that period of my life was such a blur. You know, I had babies and moved to England, and well, my wife had babies and everything sort of took off. And yeah, it's nice to hear you reflect on that, because obviously from where I was standing, I was just sort of white knuckling it, hanging on by my fingernails and hoping people didn't hate me too much or whatever the feeling is.
I mean, obviously the musical talent was always there. When did you realise that it sort of had comedy woven through it, or that they both wanted to come out at the same time?
Well, I think I always knew I was inclined to write sort of silly or quirky lyrics. I always loved words and playing with words in a way that is not very cool, you know, in a growing up in the 90s in a grunge addled Perth, West Australia. I was, yeah, a bit daggy, as we say. And I always had an inclination to muck around, and I've always been able to make people laugh even when I was playing in piano bars and stuff. But it took me till I was almost 30, till a couple of years before you came to that show. It took me till then until I realized that I was able to really hold an audience and actually do sort of stand up. And it was kind of just an accident that I became a comedian.
Let's just have a quick listen to your famous F sharp tune, which I absolutely love.
Now you don't have to be a member of Mensa to understand the depth of my dilemma. The two elements of me favour two different keys, thus the rift betwixt my fingers and my tenor. I like nothing more than playing instruments in F. It warms the very cockles of my heart. The trouble is that F can leave me vocally bereft, you see. I like playing in F major. And I like singing in F sharp. F sharp.
I just love that. I mean, it's just really hard to do that, what you do, but you make
it. Yeah, well, I certainly, listening to that recording, I certainly have to fish around for that first F sharp. The second one was better.
Yeah. Of course, you've gone on to do so many different things. People really associate you with Matilda the Musical. Were you surprised at how successful that has been? I mean, it has picked up so many awards over the years and reached, you know, 12 million people worldwide across 100 cities in 17 countries. It's huge.
Yeah, I mean, certainly sitting where I am now, it is an extraordinary thing that I could never have predicted or would never have the hubris to hope for. I certainly, when we were working on it, I thought it was pretty cool. And when it first opened in Stratford-upon-Avon in, you know, 16 years ago, whatever it was, 2010, 15 years ago, the reaction from the crowd, even on the first preview, and especially on the opening night, was something I hadn't really seen before. This, that rare thing in a theatre where people are just transfixed and their eyes are wide and teary and they leap up at the end. And we knew we were onto something, but there's so many things have to go right to have a long-running musical. You have to have it transferred and have fantastic producers. And I can't tell you how lucky I feel. But also very proud because it's a beautiful story that has fantastic messages. And, you know, there are people, many hundreds of thousands of people on the planet for whom Matilda the Musical is their first big theatre show. And I can't believe that, you know. If I had known when I was a kid that I would help to make something that was the first show that maybe millions of kids have seen, that feels profound to me. These casts are full of such extraordinary kids, such unusual brains. And, of course, these days when I walk into a rehearsal room, the kids either have no idea who I am or they absolutely lose their minds, which is quite fun. And there was a moment with this cast that's going out on tour that's going to come to Dublin where one of the kids, just before I walked in, had asked, "Is Tim Minchin still alive?" which I love, because that's because they've never known a world where Matilda doesn't exist. So as far as they're concerned, it's history.
Yeah.
And I love that. I was able to prove to him that I was extant.
Yeah, there's an Irish connection in that Alicia Weir, who performed the role in the movie version. Here's actually a clip of her singing on the Late Late Show.
Like Romeo and Juliet, 'twas written in the stars before they even met, that love and fate and a touch of stupidity would rob them of their hope of living happily. The endings are often a little bit gory. I wonder why they didn't just change their story. We're told we have to do what we're told, but surely sometimes you have to be a little bit naughty.
That's Alicia there on the Irish Late Late Show. And tickets, we should say, are on sale today for the Bord Gáis next year, 15th of September to the 18th of October. A lot of people are going to be wanting to go along to that. Your Instagram description of yourself as a songwriter, singer, pianist, actor, writer, comedian, producer, speaker, poet, reader, runner, worrier, and another word that rhymes with banker. What are the ingredients to happiness for you these days, given that you're somebody who likes to try so many things?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I get great joy out of work. I get great joy out of the fruits of my work, out of touring and people clapping and having a good time. But I also get great joy out of the hustle and the fight and the hours. I find having goals is a huge thing for me. But obviously for me, my children's well-being is the thing that changes my happiness. You know, if they're well and happy, I'm happy. Taking care of my physical health is a huge thing for me. I've always been a runner and I'm very, very lucky to still be running at 50. And if I can't run, I get very, very down very, very quickly and have to find other things to do. And I'm very lucky. I've been in a long-term relationship with someone I love for 30-something years, and I take it pretty easy, you know. I'm not hugely restless. I'm restless to work, but I don't need to buy new stuff or travel, or I just like working and chilling, really.
Yeah. Do you find your attitude to performance has changed over the years? We're about the same age, and I found something really shifted in me in the last 5 or 6 years. And that performance for me traditionally was always a kind of an anxious white knuckle ride that I was just really relieved to survive each time, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas in recent years, it seems to have transformed. It's more about I guess a feeling of gratitude for being able to connect with an audience and being more present with them. And has your attitude to performance changed?
That's a beautiful description and really echoes with what I've found. I mean, I spent a lot of time pulling back from performing and just wanting to concentrate on creating and also acting and writing telly and all those other things I wanted to try and do. But now I'm performing again and I'm back in pretty big venues. I've just been in the UK sadly didn't get across this time for 2 months or whatever, 6 weeks, 7 weeks of touring. And it, without a doubt, this year I'm turning 50, and the tour is like a 20-year anniversary tour from that first year, the year before you saw me, from my first Edinburgh. And it is very deliberately a sort of looking back.
Yeah.
And I have never had a tour where everyone stayed well, no one got sick. You know, you when you're touring, you so often get crook because you're just pushing it, and you're pushing it hard, and you're, I don't know, drinking too much and not sleeping enough. And it's because you have that white knuckle feeling. You feel, when you're younger, you feel like you don't sort of deserve it. So you kind of push really hard, you push your voice hard, and you're sort of begging the audience to like you. And I've never done a tour where I've been so just well. You know, I took care of myself, I exercised a lot, no one in the band got crook. Everyone just looked after each other, and every night we put on the absolute best show we could. We put all our focus on just putting on a great show, and exactly as you said, I'm completely focused on trying to be present in the room. And I make all my, I'm sure you do as well, actually, with your stuff, I get all my audience to turn off their phones, like properly turn off their phones and be in the room. And so it's my live gigs now are all about leaning into the fact that increasingly we live not present, not live lives. And I want my shows to be this oasis in all the, in all the input and all the screens and all the crap, where people are just with me and talking about ideas and listening to music.
Yeah, it's the audience members who have babysitters they don't trust. You can always see them because they're like, I'm not turning off my phone.
Exactly. Well, I actually open with a song about phones, and I say, you know, the kids will be fine. Trying to be present to doing the thing in front of you.
I mean, I like that you have that sense of wanting to give back and share, particularly with young people as well. I know your book, You Don't Have to Have a Dream, Advice for the Incrementally Ambitious. And I just love how that sort of pushes back against the incessant busyness and goal setting of our modern world. I do love your phrase of using micro goals. You know, what kind of ideas are you trying to share with the kids at those graduation speeches?
I think a lot of my work has always been like, even the reason I'm a comedian is because I would sit down to try and write a love song, and I'd think, oh, this is nonsense. Like the way we talk about love is so full of mythology and so devoid of the reality of what love is, that I would end up writing You Grew on Me Like a Tumor or lyrics like Your Love Is Like Fingernails on a Chalkboard. And so a lot of my work has always been about disabusing my audience of myth. And I think that's part of my role as an artist and a person with a platform is just to push back against kind of dominant narratives that I think are very popular but not necessarily very useful. And I've always been inclined to do that. I don't know, like setting yourself a big goal and dreaming. If you dream hard enough, you'll get it. And don't let go of your dreams and dream this and dream that. I mean, I don't know what that really means. And I just think you should look for the thing you're quite good at or inclined towards and work quite hard at it. And hopefully it's something that where you can contribute something to society. I got to have my so-called dreams come true by just really wanting to do a good job when I was writing songs for $500 for the children's theatre company down the road. I didn't think I was too good for that work, and I didn't try and skip that step. I didn't even see it as a step. It was an end in itself. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Like,
yeah.
Well, stop listening to sort of Oprah and just listen to your granddad about like doing a good job in the garden, and the rest, as you said, will probably look take care of itself.
Yeah, I should point out that most of the graduation speeches you're giving are actually for your own graduation, because you're Dr. Tim times three, because you've had three honorary doctorates,
totally,
which is pretty impressive.
It's crazy.
You know, any part of performance, you know, you've got to get up there, you got to do your thing and entertain people. But sometimes life gets in the way. And I was very touched by what happened a couple of years ago in terms of losing your mom, but having to perform at the same time. Tell us about that.
Well, I don't know. My mum had been sick for a while. She died quite young, 70, I think she just made it to 74. I know that doesn't sound young to your young listeners, but that's quite young when you're our age. And she'd been crook for a while, perfectly able to live her life, but we knew she wasn't going to make it. And so I was able to get home and spend some time with her when she slipped into a coma and stuff. But she stayed that way for a few days, and I decided to go home to see my kids. And I live in Sydney, and my folks are in Perth. And I wanted to honour my shows. So it has so happened that I was playing in my hometown of Sydney on the night she actually eventually died, or maybe it was the night after. And I wanted to go on. And I joked on the night that, but you know, you might think that I'm going on because it's what my mum would have wanted. She definitely would not have wanted me to go on. She would she would have wanted me to not, you know, to crumple up in a ball in grief. But I just, it's so embedded in me that the show goes on, that in a way, in that moment of grief, you fall back on your identity, right? On the thing you know. And if you don't know what to do, you do your code, right?
Yeah.
You apply your code. Hopefully that's what codes are for. That's what having ethics and a code, or a religion if you're religious, or a set of beliefs, that they're for when you're grasping, for when you're angry, you have your code to tell you why you shouldn't lash out, for when you're, I don't know. And my code is really not very complicated. It's I'm a artist, and you go on. I mean, that's a huge part of my self-understanding.
Yeah.
Is I'm someone who never misses a show. So I thought, well, go on. And I also believe that as an artist, your job is to present yourself to the audience, to entertain and to be professional, but to allow life to affect the artist you are. Especially when you're a muso, you want to allow your emotional state to flow through your fingers and into your instrument. You want to engage. And so I did the show without telling them that my mum had died because I didn't want them to freak out, because I thought they'd be worried about me. But towards the end, I shared it, because that's what art is for. It's for sharing what the human condition is with other humans. And so I was able to reflect on it and play a song and get the audience to sing along. And in doing so, I did my job.
Mm. What songs did you sing?
Well, after didn't make it easy for myself. After I told them, I did a song called "Carry You," which is a funereal song.
Sometimes I feel you with me in the dark, and your face is in the faces of the strangers walking by me in the park. And reflected in your eyes is all my love and all my lies, is all my promise and my pride, is all my fear and all my fight, is all my dread and my denial. So though we cannot be together, I know that I will carry you wherever I go. I will.
And I had to kind of do the trick of switching off. When you're doing emotional songs, when I sing White Wine in the Sun, or there's a sort of faucet, there's a valve that I feel like I can release. If I want to play White Wine in the Sun and I feel like it will serve my performance to let myself feel the feelings that I felt when I wrote it, I can kind of do that. But if I am like, oh, no, I get this, oh, no, I'm just going to cry and I'm not going to be able to sing, I can sort of switch it off.
Yeah.
And so I switched it off for Carry You. And then I did this thing I do, which is I sing sometimes. I have sung Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, which is a beautiful sort of cry into the darkness. I'm not a religious person, but I love the profundity of the human tendency to want to throw their hopes up into the darkness. And so I turn all the lights off in the theater and I get the audience to sing along. And I think it was a bit of a moment, really, because I had just engaged with that human condition of loss. I'd like to say I'll never forget it, but all my shows are a blur, if I'm honest.
Well, I can't imagine. It must have been incredibly powerful. I imagine the audience coming out in floods of tears going, I just saw Tim Minchin. He's hilarious.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think I do play that trick a bit. Yeah. I try to have my cake and eat it too.
Yeah, well, I think it's just the whole experience speaks to how authentic you are, and that's who you are, and that's what you bring to the stage, is what you bring to this conversation. People can hear it. I wonder, you know, growing up in a family that had a few medics there, what was their reaction when you told them that you wanted to live life as a rock and roll nerd?
Well, my dad was a surgeon and his dad was a surgeon. But my dad made the excellent decision to marry my mum, and in doing so kind of got the traditional, patriarchal lineage of surgical excellence sort of shaken out of him. My mum comes from a family of publicans and football players and even a mum's brother's a musician himself. And they're a bit more bohemian, my mum's family, and dad fell very much in love with my mum and her family. And my folks, I don't know if you found this growing up and having kids, but it blows my mind in hindsight how I think my parents were much more strategic than I thought. I thought they were just like being parents and being controlling or whatever. They were quite strict, but they were really thoughtful, I think, about how to parent. And one thing they did was, even though we went to, we were brought up in Perth with my dad as a surgeon, so we went to single-sex private schools. And nearly all my peers had parents who were like, you should be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever. And my parents just never, ever said that. They did, however, sort of give us the feeling that there was no mucking around, that you don't go to a school like that and throw it away, and that we were expected to get a tertiary education and were expected not to take the mick. And it just struck me that's an Australian phrase that might mean something else over there.
Yeah, we've got it too. No, in fact, yeah, we may have exported it to you.
Yeah, I'm absolutely sure it is. I grew up with an understanding that you sort of owe yourself application, I guess. Mm. And they were definitely worried when I started saying I think I want to play music and stuff. But there were early examples. When I was 18, I wrote a bunch of songs for a youth theatre show, and they came along and they just went, wow. So they were always on board, but they were very worried that I wasn't going to be able to make a living. And mum was very keen that I did a dip ed. But when I say keen, she was just like, why don't you go and do your education degree so at least you have something to fall back on? And I was like, well, maybe, but just give me another year. Just give me another year. Just give me another year. Yeah. And they kind of fell in love with my career in the end.
It sounds like you're just a beautiful mixture of the two. You've got your, creative, playful side from your mother, and you got the surgical, focused brain from your dad. Tim, I could talk to you all day. We've got to leave it there. I just want to say the tickets are on sale for the Bord Gáis Matilda show, 15th of September to the 18th of October it runs. Tickets on sale from today. BordGáisEnergyTheatre.com is the place to go.
And I do hope everyone gets to see Matilda. It is a beautiful, warm-hearted, funny, gorgeous thing, and I'm very proud of it. And I'm very, very glad it's getting back to Dublin.
Yeah, we are too. Great to talk to you, Tim. Thanks so much.
All right. See you, Dermot.
Bye-bye. Oh, thanks to Tim Minchin for chatting to us. What a lovely, lovely guy. A text from Joanne says, I've never been lucky enough to see Tim live, but I'm a massive fan. His Thank You God song even made my super Catholic 90-year-old father cackle from behind his newspaper, and that made my day. Oh, I love that, Joanne. You know, when you make someone like that, your dad or your granddad, who's a tough nut, and when you make them laugh, I think that's probably what got me into comedy years ago, trying to make my dad laugh. We were chatting to Tim Minchin, the wonderful musician and musical writer and actor and everything else, author. Someone says, I saw Tim as Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar. He was superb. Yeah, of course he was in that and got rave reviews.